Hi, I'm Roy Spencer of PermaSeal. For over 45 years, we've helped over 500,000 homeowners make their homes drier, healthier, and more valuable. Our warranties are transferable and estimates are free. Call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
Okay, let's go. Let's do some podcasting. What do you say, my friend? Reggie, yes. Well, Seth, you got your little things beeping there, whatever's going on there. Get all that stuff out of the way now, okay? All right. Are you set? I'm set. Good. Let's do this thing. Finger on the trigger? Good. Put it in the books. 472. Episode 472. All right? Cool. Star smile strong. Here we go. 3, 2. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget, I just love it when you listen. But I have to say that I'm at least enamored when you're out there telling your friends and your family and anyone else who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. I am enamored when you spread the word and let them know that it's your favorite podcast and it should be theirs too. So get out there and spread the word. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Also, of course, as always, if you enjoy what you're hearing, you can enjoy it even more going back.
Hey! That away, Ernie!
Now, there's a reference for you.
Back. Hey!
You can go back and listen to podcasts from way
back.
Just go to WGNRadio.com, go to the podcast section, go to the prompt for this podcast, and there you will be able to go back,
hey,
and listen to podcasts from the past. It's always good to know where we've been so you know where we're going. Right now, we're in the front seat putting the car in drive and going to episode number 472. So, I have to say that I recently saw a documentary on television, which I would highly, highly, highly recommend. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. I think I've mentioned this somewhere in the past. I don't know if I've done a whole podcast on it. I actually went back to WGNRadio.com and scroll down and loaded more, just like I ask you to do. I wanted to go into the past to see what I'm going to do in the future, which is right now. I thought that I might have done a podcast. I could have sworn I have on when Pee Wee Herman passed away, or on Pee Wee Herman, or discussed. I must, maybe it wasn't the main topic because of it, but I know that I've discussed Pee Wee Herman sometime in the past on this podcast. I could swear I have. And I went back to check into those same exact vaults that I tell you to go to, and I loaded more and I scrolled down. Now, Pee Wee passed away, Paul Rubens, passed away in 2023. He had apparently a relatively long battle with cancer, about 6 years or so, kept it very quiet. I don't know, certainly from the public, I don't know how much his close friends or inner circle knew, but certainly from the public, and that's part of what I want to talk about today, is part of his story. He even kept it from his documentary makers and passed away before this documentary was completely finished. And the documentary people, the director of it, Matt Wolf, had no idea that that Pee-wee was sick. Paul Rubin, I keep calling him that, and that's part of the story too. It's very easy to call Paul Rubens Pee-wee, which is part of the interesting dynamic that is explored in this new documentary called Pee-wee as Himself. Pee-wee Herman as himself. And I have to say that I definitely was and continue to be a fan of Paul Rubens, a.k.a. Pee-wee Herman. I remember watching Pee-wee and the first time that he got some kind of real mainstream attention on television was on David Letterman. I was a big fan, still am, always will be, a big fan of David Letterman. I remember watching David Letterman's morning program. David Letterman, a lot of people do not realize that David Letterman had a morning show on NBC. I believe it was after the Today Show. He had a morning talk show on NBC before he wound up getting his own show after Johnny Carson. David Letterman was a big favorite of Johnny Carson. And Johnny Carson, especially in the 70s and 80s, had tremendous power at NBC and in television and in show business in general. He was the undisputed king of late night television back when that meant something, and he just... There was no one that could come close to Johnny's influence and ratings and popularity of The Tonight Show throughout the 60s and then certainly in the 70s and 80s. By the early 90s, certainly he was getting older and his popularity began to wane, which is ultimately why NBC decided to make a change. But certainly in his heyday, And I would say not only throughout the 60s, but certainly in the 70s when he started to make, he was making tens of millions of dollars in the 1970s, which was real money back then, folks. And as I said, his popularity he had and the power he had and the place he had in show business was rarefied air. He reached an area that few entertainers can ever achieve. And especially in today's kind of diluted celebrity world, I don't think anyone will even match that kind of popularity that Johnny Carson had. And I believe it's coming on his 100th birthday. I think that Johnny would have been 100 perhaps sometime this year. I mean, the show has been off the air now for more than his Tonight Show has been off the air for more than 30 years, and The Tonight Show has gone through many, many incarnations. But my original point was that he was a big, big supporter of David Letterman. That's one of the reasons, and it's kind of the behind-the-scenes intrigue, is that most expected David Letterman to get The Tonight Show when Johnny left. Johnny was a big supporter and big fan and friend of David Letterman. David Letterman appeared many times on The Tonight Show. When Johnny was away, unlike today, where the hosts rarely leave, although Jimmy Kimmel does it, but before, Johnny Carson would regularly have guest hosts on. That is how confident Johnny Carson was of his own talent. You know, in show business, there is always somebody shooting for you, especially if you're in the catbird seat. There is always somebody shooting for you, and there's always somebody looking and waiting to take your job away, especially if you have a very coveted job. And certainly the host back then in the 70s and 80s, the idea of the Tonight Show talk show host, that was one of the most coveted jobs in all of show business. It made and broke many careers. And as I said, for Johnny Carson, it put him on the top of the entertainment world in terms of popularity, and that popularity was also transformed into power. And so David Letterman had a morning show. They didn't have him on. You know, there was no talk show on after Johnny. Johnny didn't want to do that, in fact. He wanted to have that kind of thing all to himself. But they gave Letterman a shot at a morning show, like a mid-morning show. And that wasn't that different of an idea. There were many back in once again, the 70s and even in the 80s, before the Oprah kind of talk show, which now, of course, we have the Kelly Clarksons and we've had the Ellen DeGeneres's and things like that, that were a combination. They were talk shows, but they weren't. Oprah really wasn't. She was more topics based. We had Phil Donahue before that. Oprah took it to a different level in terms of kind of the way that she presented the show. But over the last several years, there certainly have been daytime talk shows, but many of them, when you had your Geraldo Rivera's and your Sally Jesse Raphael's, and then your Jerry Springer's, they were a whole different breed of talk show. The traditional talk show format, which was with the desk and the band and the sidekick and the host, and then a little mix of celebrities as well as authors and lifestyle topics. The topics were a little lighter and fluffier during the daytime hours as opposed to nighttime, but it still held that same Tonight Show-ish, talk show-ish format that Johnny and those before him made famous. Johnny pretty much established it as the talk show host format with the desk and the sidekick and the band, and in the monologue and the whole thing. But there were some shows like that. Probably the two biggest shows in the 60s and 70s and even into the early 80s were hosted daytime shows. At least here in the United States, were hosted by a guy named Merv Griffin, who you would certainly know. If you don't remember Merv Griffin's show, everybody knows by now that Merv Griffin was not only a talk show host. Early in his days, he was a singer and a game show host, but he came to prominence as this daily talk show host, made millions and millions of dollars and was on for many years. But what really made him a mega, mega millionaire was the fact that he created, not only did he host game shows, but later on, with that in that he had for hosting them, he created two of the most popular and lucrative game shows in history, Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune, which are still on today. And even though the game shows have, now made somewhat of a revival, especially in primetime, but none match the universal popularity and not only popularity, but long-standing popularity from 40 years, and Jeopardy goes back even farther. Jeopardy has been, the Alex Trebek incarnation has been going strong now since for more than 40 years, but Jeopardy was on before that. It had a very successful run in the 60s and early 70s with another host, and now all of a sudden I'm blanking. Oh, Art Fleming. I was blanking on Art Fleming's name. It was only then, when Alex Trebek was back in the 80s, that we forgot about Art Fleming, but he was the main host of Jeopardy for many years. But Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune, both of those shows have been on for more now, been on for more than 40 years. Merv Griffin is long past, but so Merv had a daytime talk show, like very much like Johnny Carson's. Didn't have the desk all the time, moved to just kind of a little some comfortable chairs. And then a guy named Mike Douglas, also in the 60s and early 70s and sort of waned away by the time the 80s came, but certainly in the 60s and then definitely in the 70s, the Mike Douglas Show, another daytime show with an amiable singer, which Merv Griffin was as well, came out, didn't have the desk, was a little more, as I said, a little more casual, but once again had this mix of celebrities and performers, as well as authors, and talked about different topics. One of the most famous Mike Douglas shows was wild when you think about what was going on at that time. I believe it was in the early 70s. I don't know if it was what year exactly it was, but John Lennon and Yoko Ono were very controversial figures, especially after the Beatles broke up and John was kind of forging his own solo career with Yoko at his side, and they were very active in the anti-Vietnam War movement, and very viewed by many as a radical, if you will. I think it was 1972, but Mike Douglas, who was really a square guy, he was. I mean, if you ever go back and look at old Mike Douglas shows, I'm sure they're on YouTube. This was the epitome of a square guy. He came out and sang some bad songs. You could just see he was a very square ball. But that was the tone of the country of that time. There was this kind of square ball image that wholesome-ish image that appealed to people, and Mike Douglas certainly did that, as did Merv Griffin. And then later, Dinah Shore, who was a very famous singer in the 40s and 50s and 60s, wound up getting her own talk show, which was very similar, again, to Mike Douglas and Merv Griffin. But the fact that she was a woman was a big deal back then. And that was a hugely popular show, very groundbreaking show as well. So there were these daytime talk shows that were in the mold of the Tonight Show, and David Letterman had one of those. It did not last long. It was David Letterman's quirky kind of humor that was, now we think back, you look at David Letterman and you think, especially if you've only known him in the last 20 years or so, and you say, well, okay, he's funny, but that sarcasm, that quirkiness, that oddball, that irony that has now become a part of our comedic lexicon wasn't always there. As I said, it was a very kind of mainstream, kind of cornballish kind of comedy that still kind of reigned supreme, at least in prime time. That's why they put David Letterman ultimately on after Johnny, because The View was, with the popularity of Saturday Night Live in 1975, that, well, it's okay if we, maybe this counterculture, younger, hipper generation, there's certainly an audience there, but we can't really put them on when people are awake. so we'll put them on later. So the Letterman Show, in the Central Time Zone, for instance, was at 11:30 on the East Coast. The Letterman Show, his first incarnation, late night with David Letterman, was on at 12:30 at night. And that's, of course, where David Letterman started to thrive and really gain this cult following, and then a very solid following. But he first had a daytime talk show with the desk, with the monologue, doing that kind of Johnny Carson-ish kind of format with the different kind of guests, celebrities, authors, different topics. But Letterman's humor at that time was just too far ahead for the mainstream, especially for, at that time, this was still a time when women were not as much out into the workplace. It was still kind of the man goes out to work and the woman is a homemaker and a stay-at-home mom. And it was very traditional once again in that standpoint. And so David Letterman's humor at 10 o'clock in the morning, really didn't appeal. And it really wasn't on for very long. I think it wasn't even on for a year. It was on maybe, I know it was on in 1980, but it really didn't last very long. And many people thought, well, that was the end. You know, Johnny Carson's clout, I think, got David Letterman that show. To have David Letterman, amongst at that time, the all the different kind of talks or game shows like Hollywood Squares and things like that. It just didn't, in the soap operas, it just didn't seem to catch on. Letterman's comedy was just a little too edgy, for that time. A few years later, and at late night, that edginess was embraced. In fact, it was a critical success. A lot of people liked it, and younger people and critics liked it, but the mainstream audiences at that time, mostly women in the audience, just didn't appeal to them. But when Letterman got his nighttime show, as I said, this edginess became kind of cool. It was like this late night show where, the feeling was, well, not a lot of people are awake, so we can get away with anything. And it was kind of this cool place to go. And the early David Letterman shows, in the early 80s, were really, if you look at some of the guests that he had, they were far from the traditional kind of guests that later on he had on his show, into the 90s. And then when he went to CBS and went up against Jay Leno on The Tonight Show, when he didn't get the hosting job that most people thought he would, then the show became much more mainstream and it was much more a traditional kind of show. But David Letterman's late night show initially was just a very big risk taker. And they had some really oddball guests and oddball sketches and Larry Bud Melman, if you remember him, just this made up character that was completely inept and just funny. It's funny how just 2 years later, I think the Letterman show started in 82, but being just a couple years later on in late night, it was just amazing how the same humor, the same perspective that Letterman was trying to bring to the daytime show completely gelled in that later time slot. And that's where Pee-wee Herman, to get back to my original point, that's where Pee-wee Herman at least really gained his first mainstream regular exposure. Pee-wee was just the craziest thing that you'd ever seen. He came out, Paul Reubens came out, as Pee-wee Herman, with the slicked back hair and the gray suit and the bow tie and this childlike whimsy. There was a little edge to him as well, but he came out with the toys and he had the voice and the whole thing. And Pee-wee was just another oddity of the other kind of edgy, almost performance art kind of guests. Letterman didn't have, the Tom Cruises and things like that on initially. This was this late night show, this little weird little club. And so he was going for edgier kind of humor and people that you never heard of. If they had a musical guest, it was more like Frank Zappa. It wasn't going to be, it wasn't going to be Blondie, Debbie Harry at the time, which is what made the show so cool. And it was so different from The Tonight Show. And that's why Johnny didn't feel any competition or threat from Letterman, because it's like they were doing the same thing but on a whole different level and a whole different plane. And like I said before, Johnny had such confidence in his popularity that he would always have guest hosts all the time, and Letterman was one of those too. He would be on vacation and have guest hosts on during the week he would have guest hosts on. He had a lot of vacation time. But he was so confident in his standing. They always say, you know, be careful. As I said before, you know, there's a lot of people gunning for your job. But Johnny didn't feel that way. Johnny was so confident because he just wiped the floor with any kind of late night competition. So he didn't care if somebody did even if somebody did a great job as a host. He had no fears that they would someday take away his own job. Now, interestingly enough, there was some backstage drama on The Tonight Show. Back in the 80s, Joan Rivers was a guest host several times with The Tonight Show, to the point where she got so popular in that role that she became his permanent guest host. And so whenever Johnny was on vacation, instead of now having this revolving door of people, Joan Rivers was the, if Johnny wasn't on, Joan was on. And her popularity got so great in doing that for a couple of years in the 80s that Fox Network, which was trying to gain some traction, it had just become a network and was trying to gain some traction, they stole her away and put her on against Johnny. And of course, then Johnny was really angry, felt betrayed, and never spoke to Joan Rivers again. He felt like, hey, I give you the break of a lifetime, and all you showed me was you went to a rival network and went up against me to try to beat me. Joan's view was, hey, this is show business. We're all striving to get to the top. So there was always acrimony between Johnny and Joan Rivers. Then, of course, Jay Leno then became the permanent host when Johnny wasn't there. Then that's where Leno got into the mix, even though Johnny and Letterman, especially the last several years with his popularity on NBC right after Johnny, it was almost a no-brainer that Letterman would take over. He was the assumed heir apparent. He was Johnny Carson's personal favorite to be the heir apparent. But the fact of the matter was that the bosses at NBC felt like Letterman's appeal was was still not mainstream. Yes, the late night show was very popular. It was well respected. It was cutting edge. It was everything. But once again, these are the perceptions that people have. And the perceptions were, yeah, but is he ready for the big seat? Can he be a mass appeal host? And they already knew that Jay Leno could be, based on the ratings he had when he filled in for Johnny. So even though Letterman was working 5 days a week for 10 years hosting a show, and Jay came in and filled in, when the time came to get the job, Letterman being a loyal employee of NBC, hosting a show for 5 years, putting in his time, and they gave it to Jay Leno because they had some data that Jay Leno could get ratings in that 10:30 slot or the 11:30 slot, if you will, if on the East Coast. And that's when Letterman got mad and then left and then went to CBS and went up against Leno. And then that's the sort of the landscape we have today. But anyway, so that's where I first saw Pee-wee Herman. Now, people may be if you had a close eye, you know that Pee-wee Herman got his start in a bigger sense. He was in a couple of Cheech and Chong movies. And if you look close, in 1980... Pee-wee, Paul Rubens, is the waiter at the Shea Paul in the Blues Brothers film. Short role, small role, but even you could, Paul Rubens just had something. I could still quote lines from the Blues Brothers film. Just love that movie. It's 45 years old now. And even though it was, one scene and Paul Rubens was hardly in it, but there's a great line that Paul Rubens has, and it's not even a funny line, but it's his delivery and his look and whatever it is about Paul Rubens. He looks like Pee-wee very much, the hair slicked back, but I think either Belushi or Aykroyd says, you know, what do you have to drink? And he just, you know, he's very straight-laced, and he's like, we've got Dom Perignon at $125 a bottle. Okay, that's not even a funny line, right? There's nothing funny about that. But I still remember it because of just the way Paul Rubens delivered it within the context of the scene. This snooty restaurant, he was the snooty waiter. The Bruce Brothers were these bawdy guys that didn't belong in there. It was perfect. And I remember when I saw the Blues Brothers later, I'm like, wait a minute, that's Pee Wee Herman. Who knew? At the time, it's just, remember that waiter. But yeah, so I first had my first exposure, I think as most people did, to Pee Wee Herman through his appearances on Late Night with David Letterman, because when he came on, his character and his comedy was so off the wall. It was so different. It really was performance art before people even really knew what that meant or really completely grasped it, like, you know, people like Andy Kaufman and others that made it so so popular. He was completely committed to the character of Pee Wee Herman, this childlike man, this man-child who dressed in this tight gray suit with the white shoes and the red bow tie and the hair slicked and played with toys and as I said, talked like this kind of this man boy using, you know, immature kind of phrases. I know you are, but what am I? And if you like it so much, why don't you marry it? And things like that. And at the same time, there was an edge to him. And that's what was so interesting. He talked like a little kid, but there was a dark side to Pee-wee if you really listened. And that's what was so interesting about that character. And it became so popular that Letterman had him on a weekly or monthly basis. And you looked forward to the Pee-wee Herman appearances because it was like, wow, what is going on? And his star really rose quickly. And it was because, in many ways, of that exposure he got on Letterman. Now, the fact of the matter is that he had developed this Pee-wee Herman character as a part of the improv group that gave life to many of some of the greatest comedians in the last 40 or 50 years. It's an improv group, much like Second City, but this was on the West Coast, called the Groundlings. And Paul Rubens was a member of the Groundlings, as were many of the comedians that went on to star on Saturday Night Live or become stand-up comedians or even, you know, comic actors, got their start at the Groundlings. In fact, an interesting part of the whole Paul Rubens, Pee-wee Herman story is the fact that Phil Hartman, who later became a mainstay on Saturday Night Live, got his start at the Groundlings and worked with Pee-wee Herman, and they were actually collaborators on the whole Pee-wee Herman character. And so, as many people know, between his appearances, and then he had a movie, of course, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which was a huge, huge hit, which then led to a sequel, which was not as big of a hit. And then, of course, his TV show, Pee-wee's Playhouse, which was a morning TV show on Sundays. Once again, I'm talking about morning talk shows. This was another kind of weird, quirky concept of having a kids show. Don't forget, back in the history of television, children's morning shows were very popular. Captain Kangaroo, Soupy Sales, you know, here in Chicago, things like Ray Rayner, Howdy Doody. In the early days of television, you know, shows aimed at kids and shows aimed at women, especially during the day, were hugely popular because that's who was home. As I said before, in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s and even well into the 80s, the nuclear family was still intact. And the whole idea was that the father went to work and the mom took care of the kids or was the homemaker. And so a lot of early television programming, especially during the day, between the soap operas and the quiz shows and the daytime talk shows, were aimed at women, or as I said, the morning children shows, like here in Chicago. I said Bozo Circus was on at noon, but still, Ray Rayner, Garfield Goose. There were tons of puppet shows and, you know, Kukla, Fran, and Ollie shows aimed at kids, especially in the morning, because kids were home. They'd wake up early, or they were home during the day. And most of us grew up with those shows. I was a little too old for Howdy Doody, but I certainly remember the last several years of Captain Kangaroo. And here in Chicago, there's a show called Romper Room as well. A lot of shows aimed at kids. I don't remember the Soupy Sales show. That was there and gone before. I was too young for that, or too old for that. No, I was too young at the time. I wasn't even born. So that show of Pee-wee's Playhouse put on in the 90s was this kind of throwback to these morning children's shows, which were no longer on anymore. In the 70s and 80s, Saturday morning were all cartoon shows. Once again, aimed at kids. Kids are home on Saturdays. There were no talk shows. There were nothing. That was what, there was only three networks, folks. Kids shows, cartoon shows were on from like 8 o'clock in the morning to about 10 or 11. Then the adult programming started. And so Paul Rubens, a.k.a. Pee-wee Herman, just was a genius in combining that kind of nostalgic throwback that brought in adults who remembered growing up with Captain Kangaroo and Soupy Sales and Howdy Doody. And now here was somebody of their age group that they could relate to, who was a little edgy, who was a little counterculture, who was a little dangerous, with a lot of double entendre kind of humor, but at the same time was presented in this childlike character who could appeal to kids as well. And that's what made Pee-wee's Playhouse so unique and so smart, is that it worked on many levels. It appealed to young kids as a TV, as a children's informative, educational, and silly morning show, and it appealed to their parents and younger people who were looking at this kind of cool, cutting edge, slightly dark, slightly dangerous comedy guy who was kind of winking at the adults while smiling at the kids. It was genius. And I have to say that all of that and more is presented in this new documentary, which, if you were a Pee-wee Herman fan, it's a must to see. But if you're a fan of pop culture, especially if you're a younger person or even an older person who doesn't know a lot of the background, I think it's very informative and revealing to give you a sense of, you know, people have heard about Pee-wee Herman, but there was so much mystery about him. And a lot of that was deliberate. And for the first time, Paul Rubens as an actor, Paul Rubens as a performer, Paul Rubens as a player, as a person, was very guarded and very isolated, and put a wall around him. Part of that was because of the character he created. He was a performance artist, and in the true sense of the word, so much so that he abandoned his real identity as Paul Rubens. And as the Pee-wee character took off, he was no longer identified as Paul Rubens, but he was Pee-wee Herman. And that's why when you talk about him, a lot of times, you know, even my in casually talking about him, as you can hear, I will go back and forth between saying Pee-wee and Paul Rubens. And I have to even make a mental note of that, because when you're talking about the person, you want to say Paul Rubens, but it's easy to say Pee-wee because they were one and the same. He made a conscious effort and a conscious decision to forego his real persona of Paul Rubens and be completely committed and invested in the Pee-wee Herman character, which made that character so popular and so unique and a classic, a timeless classic. Now, as we know, many of you may not know the full extent of it, especially if you're younger. Those of us who have been following Pee-wee's career know that his career was also very controversial. And he got in trouble with the law, which really had a hugely negative impact on his career. At the height of his career, it was an amazing downfall. And what this documentary, for the first time, gets into is Paul Reubens' explanation of it to some extent, and a real exploration into the entire controversy. It happened twice to him, and you don't know if it was self-sabotage. You don't know if it was being targeted. You know, we love to build people up and then tear them down, especially in the entertainment world, whether it's sports or entertainers or politicians. But what is sad is that in this documentary called Pee-wee as Himself, which is on HBO and Max, it's two parts. It's over 2 hours. It's over 3 hours long. I think each episode is over 100 minutes, so that's 3 hours. But I'll tell you, it is riveting. It keeps your attention. After part one, you want to watch part two. This director, Matt Wolf, did a great job of not only putting this story together, thanks to, I think, 40 hours of interviews with Paul Reubens himself before he passed away, as well as archival footage, and really giving a full revealing portrait of this person named Paul Reubens, who became Pee-wee Herman, who really went toward the top echelon of the entertainment world very quickly, and then just met a tragic fall, not once, but twice, and never really fully recovered, either professionally or personally. And it is a tragic tale. It really is. As fun and whimsical as this story is in many cases, because of the Pee-wee character, because you know the ending, there is this sense of doom that hovers over it, and it's just infused in it, because you know that as exciting as this ascent is, and it's very well documented in this interview or in this documentary through the archival footage, as well as the different interviews with Paul Reubens, you see a very interesting story of his upbringing with his family, with his drive to be creative. He was a restless soul. He was an artistic soul. He was a complex person. He was closeted. He was gay. But once again, in the late 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, and especially if you're going to be hosting a kid's show, we look at today in 2025 and, you know, we still see there's certainly prejudice against gays, and we're talking here right in the midst of Pride Month. There certainly is a stigma, and there still certainly is a prejudice against gays, especially that's been expanded now with the transgender movement as well. But believe me, whatever prejudices that might exist today against gays, they were not as strong, not as negative, and not as vehement as they were in the 70s and the 80s. And that's why many actors, even today, actors and actresses you don't know, while many are very open about their sexuality or their sexual orientation, whether it's trans, whether it's gay, many have come out and they're very proud of it, and they don't try to hide it, but there are still unbeknownst to you, actors and actresses who are still closeted, who are still afraid that their public image will be destroyed, that their career will be destroyed if they admit and come out of the closet. And that's a sad commentary on today as we sit here in 2025, but that is still, sadly, the perception that some have. And Paul Rubens was as I said, came up into prominence during this time. When you just kept that quiet. If you wanted to be a mainstream entertainer. Now, others in today's world, in the 90s and 2000s, look at Ellen DeGeneres, Rosie O'Donnell, completely embraced. But even Rosie was in the closet for many years when she had her talk show in the 90s. You know, she played the game. You know, Ellen, when she first came on her first on television, she didn't say she was lesbian. Even when she had her own comedy series, she played a straight woman. In fact, when she came out as a lesbian, the character on the show, she came out as a lesbian in real life. That was a major deal when that happened. A lot of people don't remember it. It feels like ancient history. It wasn't all that long ago. And especially people that are in their 20s, they might not even understand that. What are you talking about? Closeted and people, what do you mean people didn't admit they were gay? What are you talking? Why? Why wouldn't they? And what this? It's hard for people to grasp, but that's the way society was. We are still a Judeo-Christian kind of country, you know, founded. That's how our founding fathers came here as pilgrims for religious freedom. And as much as the country has moved and progressed culturally, there is still a hesitancy, an apprehension. People accept it, but, I mean, the fact that people can get married, gay people can get married today legally, that people can, you know, younger people, they can't even understand what an impossibility that was 40, 50, 30 years ago. The idea of gay people getting legally married was, you couldn't even fathom it. And that's no deny. That's not an opinion. That's fact. So we certainly have moved forward in acceptance, but not completely. And Paul Rubens was a closeted gay man, which, as I said, you know, complicates this story in many ways. What's so fascinating about this new documentary, it's a two-parter on HBO and Max, is that Paul Rubens is involved. He endorses it. He contributes to this in many ways. Many documentaries, many times, documentaries are made without the main subject's participation or approval. And it's, you know, a documentary then is put together with archival footage, talking to friends, but the actual person isn't involved. For as isolated and private as a person as Paul Rubens was, for him to have finally stepped forward and participated in this lets you know, in some ways, even though he didn't reveal it to the makers of the documentary, there's no question that he knew he had cancer. He knew that he might be dying soon. And his was one of these entertainment stories that was never fully explained. We didn't have all the information. And in many ways, his narrative, his legacy, was going to be defined by other people. And to some extent, sadly, it still is. But at least he was given a chance to tell his own story as much as he could while he didn't produce or direct the documentary, and the documentary maker, as I said, Matt Wolff, certainly had a vision for this, but it was a vision that I think he wanted to let Pee-wee, Paul Reubens, tell his story. And what's so fascinating about this is to see the interviews and the cut-ins with Paul Reubens, because while he is, there's a constant yin and yang, and there's a constant conflict. And you could see how Paul Reubens was wounded by the controversy that befell him personally and professionally. He was conflicted with being honest, with being so transparent about his life, because he was clearly a guarded person. He was also clearly a control freak, and a very driven and ambitious person. But that control or that vision is what helped propel him. He had a very clear vision of this character, Pee-wee Herman, that he created. And he knew what Pee-wee would do and what Pee-wee wouldn't do. And in many ways, he and Pee-wee were the same. It's almost like the ventriloquist and the ventriloquist dummy. You sometimes wonder which one is real and which one isn't. Pee-wee was almost Paul Reubens' ventriloquist dummy. Their personalities were almost intertwined. A lot of that, as I said, was deliberately done because Paul Reubens was truly a committed performance artist. But you can see when Paul Reubens is talking here, very bluntly, there's a distrust, there's an arrogance, there's a control factor. He's being coy, being a little paranoid. He's being funny, kind of sly. It's all there. And if you go back and watch a lot of the Pee-wee shows and movies, those same attributes were there as well. But because the Pee-wee character was so childlike in its presentation, a lot of times that didn't come through, which made it even more interesting. Because there was this dark side to Pee-wee, and there's definitely a dark side to Paul Reubens. And so what's so interesting is you can sense, and you even hear a back and forth between the director and Paul Reubens sometimes in these interviews. He's holding his ground. I give this Matt Wolff, a lot of credit. He does not back down. He stands up to Paul Reubens and doesn't let him get away with not answering a question. And the interesting thing is that Paul Reubens in some of these exchanges is very antagonistic. And many times he says, well, I don't know why I couldn't just direct this and I could do this. I mean, everybody's telling me that I don't have a perspective on myself, but I could have done this. And there's this weird tension, this controlling factor that clearly played a role in his rise, because he knew Pee-wee and he controlled that character very much, and that's what made it successful. And now in his own personal life, as he's coming to terms with some of these things and speaking about them publicly for the first time, you could see that he wants to again control the narrative. He controlled the narrative on Pee-wee Herman, and now he wants to control the narrative on Paul Reubens, especially since in his mind, he was unfairly treated by the public and by the law and by show business. And so there's a sense where he wants to remain guarded, but you could see that there's also a catharsis going on, and he wants to just finally talk about this in an honest way. So that's what's fascinating about this. Not only do we get a very nice overview, interesting, retrospective of his career, some revealing things about his personal life, his upbringing, his childhood, his family with his parents and his sister, his early life as a little kid, going to camp, going to high school, being creative, going to college, meeting, you know, having relationships with men. It's all there. This is a very warts and all kind of background. And you give Paul Rubens a lot of credit for allowing them. And when you know, too, just like Pee-wee, that there's this, as I said before, you know this impending doom that hovers around this story. It makes it all the more compelling because as you're watching this all, begin to unfold, you know where the ending's going to be. And there's still a question that hangs out there. As honest as he is, I don't know if even he can understand or even admit to, the self-sabotage that seems to have happened. For those of you who don't remember or don't know, it's very well documented that at the height of his career, at the height of his popularity, with Pee-wee's Playhouse being one of the most popular television shows on television, having this winning streak with Big Top Pee-wee and this persona, he was a pop culture icon in his own time. You know, icons usually are you, I mean, now we throw around that adjective around much too simple, you know, just like we say genius. We throw that around too easily. But most of the time when you use the word iconic, it means something from the past that we look back and retrospectively and say, wow, that turned into an iconic thing. At the time, we didn't realize it, but now with 30 years behind, wow, that was groundbreaking or iconic. Pee-wee reached a level that few reach. He was an iconic figure just visually. And universally popular, as I said, because he appealed to adults because of his edgy humor. He appealed to adults because he was kind of this nostalgic throwback to a more innocent time when they were growing up. And then he appealed to young kids because he was this whimsical man-child. And so Pee-wee Herman, the character, people might not remember, but I mean, not only, he was a toy. I still have my Pee-wee doll and Cherry. I still have my Pee-wee watch. I mean, he was all over the place. There was tons of merchandise around Pee-wee's Playhouse and Pee-wee himself. He was a phenomenon. In the midst of this, at the height of this, ironically, came this story in the early to mid-90s that Paul Rubens, looking as un-Pee-wee-like as possible, I mean, Pee-wee Herman character, skinny, clean-shaven, red rouge cheeks, almost looked like a doll, slick back hair, pale, skinny, dark eyebrows, makeup, whole thing. And meanwhile, in Florida, where his parents were from, where he was from, in Sarasota, I think he was either visiting friends or visiting his family at the time on hiatus. In the midst of all his popularity, the most unlikeliest story comes out that Pee-wee Herman exposed himself in a pornographic theater. Now, people might even say, what's a pornographic theater? Because once again, it was only 30 years ago, but we don't even know that. Talk about, I've always talked about how, technology has replaced things that we don't even remember anymore. There, now, I mean, you could watch porn anytime, anywhere, anyhow, on your phone, anywhere. Pornography has become a one of the threads of our fabric here, for better or worse. The access to it is wide open. But that wasn't always the case. once again, different time. There were actually X-rated theaters where people went to watch pornography because there was nowhere else to watch it. Now, back in the 90s, that was dying out as well because the home video world brought porn into the home. But there were still a few straggling kind of little seedy, you know, X-rated theaters that showed pornography. And for whatever reason, not Pee-wee Herman, Paul Rubens went to one of these places. Certainly not looking like Pee-wee Herman at all. In fact, when he was arrested for indecent exposure and possibly manipulating himself in public, he looked anything but Pee-wee Herman. He kind of looked like Elvis Costello, really. Long hair, dark sunglasses, goatee, just, you couldn't get any farther away looking from Pee-wee than Paul Rubens looked in his mugshot. And you can go online and see it. And it literally tanked his career overnight, especially since you've got a performer who is raising, who's come to prominence as a children's show host, being arrested for indecent exposure and other things in a pornographic theater, that doesn't bode well if you're a kid, a performer of a children's show. And so overnight, the show was canceled. His career just went from the top of the heap to the bottom. It was a sad descent. And you wonder, and you don't really get, this is something that maybe until that he never really reconciled or really wasn't ready to fully reveal. But it almost felt like it was such a crazy concept and a crazy idea. And for a man who was very controlling and very shrewd and very smart, he was deliberately closeted himself because he knew of the implications. And yet here he seemed to throw complete caution to the wind. It was almost as if the Pee-wee train was on a track and it was isolating him, and he wanted to get off the Pee-wee track because he had so melded his own persona and his own personality into that. He almost relinquished Paul Rubens. And maybe there was something, you know, emotionally or mentally that he wanted to be Paul Rubens again. But he knew that he couldn't be because he himself destroyed, you know, surrendered Paul Rubens. But internally, he might have longed to be Paul Rubens again. Maybe he wanted to be an actor and do other things, but he was so identified, which was why the character became so popular, because he was so committed to it. And that was also what probably, you know, may have just found him in a desperate thing of how do I get off this Pee-wee train? And he realized that he could never do that unless he destroyed it himself, because it seemed like such a deliberate act. And it was so far, you knew, it was almost like he was trying to get caught because he knew that he could not end this unless it was ended by some outside force. And so he's so cautious and deliberate and focused on the Pee-wee character. And here, this seemed almost so just irresponsible to that it almost seemed like it was self-inflicted. Whatever the motivation was, there's no question about it. It hurt him immensely. His reputation, his career, at the same time, with the mainstream audience, And that's what you have to keep that in mind again. I told you, he started as kind of this quirky, counterculture-ish, you know, edgy performance artist. That's how he started the character at the Groundlings, then at the Roxy in L.A. It was a kind of a subversive thing. That's what was so interesting about the Pee-wee character. He was childlike, but he was also, as I said before, dark and almost subversive. That's what made it. There was always a little edge to Pee-wee. Now he, you know, but obviously CBS immediately canceled the show, and for a long time. Now the irony is that at the end of the day, you know, this act, this arrest, which was so detrimental to his career and his persona and his reputation, it wound up, you know, being, you know, a misdemeanor charge with $100 fine and probation or something. But, you know, this wasn't like, you know, I mean, certainly people were making comments about him, but ultimately this wasn't murder, but it was so out of character with this character that he created. And it was just perfect for the tabloids. As I said, you know, the tabloids and the media in general, they love to build someone up and then they love to tear them down when they get to the top of the heap. And Pee-wee was a prime example of that. Paul Rubens was a prime example of that. Now, he made a kind of a triumphant comeback because while the mainstream people, well, this is outrageous. They all had to be aghast at this. But, you know, there was the adult side and the hipster side, the people that were younger, they kind of saw through that. And Pee-wee made a triumphant return at one of the MTV Video Awards. And he got, when he came out, he'd been out of the public eye for a few years now. And when he returned at the MTV Awards, and he walked out at the beginning of the show, he got a rousing standing ovation. And it was clear, I think it was like the 91, MTV, Music Awards. And it was clear that there was a good portion of the people, while the media and some people, you know, showed outrage at this craziness and all this stuff, there was a huge part of the Pee-wee fan base that really didn't care about that. And so he was able to come back to some extent, but it was just not the same. And he was he made appearances in other TV shows and movies. He was in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. He was in the movie called Blow. He was around. He sort of inched his way back as Paul Rubens, not as Pee-wee. You know, back into that. He even pops up on an Elton John video in the 2000s. He plays Elton's manager, John Reed, for a song called This Train Don't Stop There Anymore. Which also stars Justin Timberlake as Elton. And hilarious cameo in the early 2000s on Everybody Loves Raymond. He played one of the characters, Amy, you know, Robert's, you know, Brad Garrett's wife, Amy's brother, who owns the comic book shop. Russell, his name was. And Pee-wee Herman, who I guess was a friend to Phil Rosenthal, one of the creators of Everybody Loves Raymond. And he played this character. He had this long hair. He's wearing, you know, he owned a comic book shop, this kind of, you know, comic book kind of nerdy guy. And he put just one scene, but every time that episode is on, I have to watch it. He is so great. And the sad part is that that character wound up becoming a regular on the Raymond show. You may remember Amy's brother then was named Peter, was played now I'm blanking on his name. Jeez. Chris. Oh, my God. Come on. Chris, what's his name? Oh, Jesus. Chris. I'm going to look. I have to look it up here now. Chris who? Come on. Oh, my God. Oh, no, this is embarrassing. Chris Elliott, right. Chris Elliott. But Chris Elliott played the role of Peter, who there were little similarities between the original character that Pee-wee created as Russell, the comic book character, the comic book store owner, who was Amy's brother, and then Chris Elliott, who took over the role, different name, and took it to a little different direction. But there's no doubt that Pee-wee, Paul Reubens, would have become a semi-regular on Raymond, because they made that character and they continued that character. They changed the name because then Pee-wee got in trouble again in 2002 and got arrested again, this time for having pornographic material in his house and possibly underage porn. And he was now being labeled a pedophile. The fact of the matter is that Pee-wee Paul Reubens, as I said, you always keep, you know, and this documentary shows, you know, he was a quirky, kitschy kind of guy. He had an amazing collection of pop culture stuff, just crazy things, you know, warehouses full. And he had these old, some of these things he didn't even ever open, but they were like these old, funky films from the 50s and comic books and magazines and just old nostalgic things that were kind of in Pee-wee's Playhouse as well, that kind of nostalgic look. And I think he was targeted. I think there was some disgruntled person that decided to target him, and he got arrested again. And even though those charges wound up, you know, he wound up settling with a $50 fine and something like that, but it once again kind of just reinforced what he was able to finally, in some extent, put away for 10 years. It came back again. And he never really fully recovered after that. As I said, he popped up here and there. But it was as if it was just one time too many. So the Paul Reubens story is very tragic. It's very exciting. It's very fun to watch. It's very exciting. But it's also very sad and very tragic. And sometimes you wonder, was this self-inflicted or not? Paul Reubens was a very complex person, which I think is why the Pee-wee character was so perfect in how he created him. And we find a lot of different things. As I said, he was very ambitious, very driven. As I said, we see Phil Hartman, who was a major contributor to the Pee-wee creation of the Pee-wee Herman show, which began as a sketch at the Groundlings. And then he and Phil Hartman had a falling out over some creative differences and things like that. He was clearly a very driven, smart, complex, troubled, confused, paranoid, immensely creative person. And all that comes through. And we actually get, and sadly, he passed away before this was actually completed. And we don't get to see a final interview with him to sort of sum it all up, because as I said, he passed away from cancer while this was being filmed. But you do hear a final audio recording that he must have known he was toward the end. He recorded a final kind of statement about his life and career. And you could hear his voice is very weak and fragile, but it's also very honest and very genuine. And I have to say, if you were a fan of Paul Reubens or Pee-wee Herman or both, you really should make sure to try to to check this out. It's called Pee-wee as Himself, directed by Matt Wolff, who does just an excellent job of pushing Paul Reubens to tell that story, to give those insights. It's, as I said, it's a fascinating give and take, because you could see he still wants to remain guarded, but at the same time, he also knows in the back of his mind, unbeknownst to anyone else, that this is his last chance to tell this story. And so as much as I want to maybe have told it a different way, this is what's in front of me, and I've got to take this opportunity. And so we still get the revelations. We still get the inside stories. And as much as he pretends like he doesn't want to say it, then he goes on and elaborates. It's really interesting to watch that very closely and to see this footage of him and his rise and his fall and his friends. And you hear so many people talk about what a nice, quiet person he was, and yet he had this public persona that was just so huge and so big. He was driven to be, he wanted to be noticed. He wanted to be a star. And if you were around in the mid-80s and early 90s, to see how fast he rose from some early appearances in 1982 or 83 on David Letterman, within a year or so, he was a major movie star. And within 5 years, he was a major television star and phenomenon, between Pee-wee's Big Adventure film and then Pee-wee's Playhouse on television. It's quite a story. It's really an engrossing film and documentary. It's confessional. It's funny. You know, as I said, you see this and you see the self-destructiveness of it. You know, it's revealing, and it's emotional. But the story is framed well. It's told well. We see people like, you know, other people that helped contribute and also went on to bigger, you know, careers. Tim Burton directed Pee-wee's Big Adventure. It was his first major film. Phil Hartman, some other people who knew him coming up. I said the early appearances on Letterman are there. It's really a well done, interesting story. We get as much as we ever could from Paul Reubens, certainly more than we ever got, in terms of explaining who he was and why he was and what he did, and how he felt after everything collapsed. It's quite a story. It's almost like a Shakespearean tragedy in many ways. So if you are a pop culture fan, if you are a Paul Reubens fan, or if you are a Pee-wee Herman fan, if you still have your Pee-wee doll and your cherry and your Pee-wee watch and things like that, Pee-wee Herman as Himself, right now available on the streaming service of Max, on Showtime as well. Check it out, because it's an engrossing look at, once again, a crazy, crazy story. And I think you'll love it. And if you love it so much, then, well, why don't you marry it? And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNradio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. And it should be theirs, too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 472. I'm Jim Toronto. I'm here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. From the end of my mind to your ears.